And it's funny because she said that the thing she would have changed is having a better informed team. I feel like that's the thing that shaped me. If I grew up in a community, like a place that has a huge structure for built for sickle cell patients, where the hematologists are sickle cell specialists, mm-hmm. the nurses are nurse practitioners specializing in hematology for sickle cell patients, everybody from the phlebotomist to everybody is well aware and well informed about sickle cell, I feel like I would have been completely complacent, not as good as an advocate, and it would have taken me a much longer time to understand that not everybody knows what you need, cares what you need, and is even, not everybody cares. So you're going to have to figure this out, mm-hmm. educate, and you're going to have to find ways to explain to doctors that they don't know everything.
Welcome to Health Hats, empowering people as they travel together toward best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege, living in a food oasis who can afford many hats, and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare, and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in healthcare's Tower of Babel. Let's make some sense of all of this.
In earlier episodes, we heard from Sarah Lorraine. Sarah's in high school. And we heard from Morgan in college. This episode concludes the conversations I've had with Fatima Muhammad Igala, a mother with two children, and her mother, Asosa, as they navigated sickle cell disease. These conversations have been different, as Fatima and I are friends. We are familiar with each other's families. We have shared some of life's milestones. In this episode, Fatima finds that she's turning into her mother and describes her experience as a young mother of color seeking pain relief from a sickle cell crisis as the opiate crisis heats up. Hang on.
Sosa and Fatima, it is just wonderful that you've joined me. I thank you so much. What I want to do is ask a few questions of you, and I'm going to start with you, Isosa, okay?
Okay.
You've managed five kids, two of them with sickle cell, and so now that they're older, and you're older, and maybe wiser, who knows, what would you do differently now that you've had all this experience?
Oh, I wouldn't change a thing, because I just know that God has a plan for every one of us, and it comes to pass. So I wouldn't change anything, but I would have preferred if none of my kids had any disease, you know.
Yes.
But we don't get to choose.
But I guess I'm thinking about all the challenges that you had with the doctors and the hospital and the schools. Is there something about that you wish was different? Or now that you know what you know, you might have approached it differently? Any of those challenges?
Yes, I was able to make the school system aware of the challenges we were having, because I have a supportive team of hematologists and pediatricians and all of them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the thing that would have helped us along the way better would have been more awareness.
Meaning, you know, that the schools and the doctors would have known more about sickle cell early on.
Yes, that would have been very helpful. But instead of them telling me what to do about the disease, I ended up doing my own research and providing them information.
So you were teaching them?
Oh, yes. Not that I know much. I don't know much, but I was doing research and providing the schools, and even my pediatrician was very honest by telling me that he didn't know too much about the disease, but they were willing to work with me.
Okay. Well, so that's really good. I think the hardest thing is when people don't know that they don't know.
Yes.
When people say, okay, well, I don't know, and then they're willing to learn, that's a start, Okay. Fatima,
yes.
Question for you. So, you know, when you and I worked together and we were talking about our respective chronic challenges, illness challenges. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you were pretty strong about was self-care. And you would say to me, what are you doing to take care of yourself? How are you managing the stress? Are you spending enough time with your grandkids? Or, you know, whatever. You would be talking to me about that.
Oh, I did? I'm sorry.
You did, definitely. It was great. I mean, I felt like that's something that we were able to share. How do we take care of ourselves? When did you first realize that your mother needed to take care of herself? Here she was taking care of the five of you and spending all this time. And as you said, you know, when you were 10, you just knew everything. But there was a moment where you were growing up and you realized, oh, it wasn't just about you. It was about the whole family and it was about your mother. How did that happen that you started thinking about what she was going through?
If I'm going to be honest, it took a long time. And it's not until I went to college and I realized, wow, life is hard. Like I went 10 hours away, driving distance in a completely different state. It was the first time I was without my parents, my family. I have a huge extended family, so I was without, I didn't know anybody, and I was just there by myself. Mm-hmm. And I had to, and nobody there to say, stay hydrated or don't stay up late. And I would pull all-nighters and eat like crap, like the other students, and then end up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So it took like a couple of times of that to realize, my God, I can't do that. I can't stay up all night. I have to stay hydrated. I still ate like crap, but I had to at least squeeze like one actually nutritious meal in there. When I had to actually take care of myself mentally, physically, and I realized what a huge role my mom played, and I was just like, how does she do this? That's actually when I realized she's a person and just saw her outside of like my mom, just my on-call pro bono PA, my nurse practitioner, my chef, all this like unpaid work that she did just purely out of love. I was like, oh my gosh. I remember calling my mom like, I didn't know detergent was this expensive. And she was just like, yeah, that's your budget, make it work. And I was like, but you don't understand. It's really, I was telling her that she didn't understand like how expensive life was, you know? So I think that was the first time I really realized like, wow, she's a person. And then whenever I come home, I just appreciated her way more. Mm-hmm. And then again, when I gave birth to my first child, I was like, no, not only is she a great person, she's like superwoman, she's amazing. She's like not real. So that's when a lot of things really clicked and I realized how much I loved my daughter and my child. And I was like, oh my God, it must have really killed her heart to watch me being in pain. And yet she still went out of her way to make me try to be independent and put away her mommy hat, not her mommy hat. She put a, she looked at the future and she put on the hat that I needed at that moment to become the person that she need, that I needed to be to make it through the world. So instead of just kissing me and cuddling me like I would have liked at that moment and like she would have wanted to do, she really wanted me to be something, be independent. So I think at that moment is when I had a whole nother realization that really just, it was a deeper realization than when I was just in college trying to take care of myself.
See the show notes or my website, www.health-hats.com for more information or to subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks.
And it's funny because she said that the thing she would have changed is having a better informed team. I feel like that's the thing that shaped me. If I grew up in a community like University of Pittsburgh healthcare system or Gainesville in Florida, a place that has a huge structure for built for sickle cell patients where the hematologists are sickle cell specialists, mm-hmm. the nurses are nurse practitioners specializing in hematology for sickle cell patients. Mm-hmm. Everybody from the phlebotomist to everybody is well aware and well informed about sickle cell. I feel like I would have been completely complacent, not as good as an advocate.
Oh, and it
would have taken me a much longer time to understand that not everybody knows what you need, cares what you need, and is even not everybody cares. So you're going to have to figure this out, mm-hmm. educate, and you're going to have to find ways to explain to doctors that they don't know everything because, you know, that comes with really fragile ego. I don't know what they feed them in medical school. Mm-hmm. That causes some people to have such fragile egos. So I feel like it really helped me learn how to navigate the healthcare system as an mm-hmm. advocate for myself. And mm-hmm. so it's funny that that's what she picked is what she would change. And I feel like that's the thing that actually helped me, seeing her advocate for me and going above and beyond. If she didn't know something, learn about it, ask questions, figure it out, and then educate. And then I think that was transformative. That was helpful. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's so interesting. You know, it's kind of ironic, but it makes sense. Fatima is as independent-minded, and I have a feeling as stubborn as you are. the apple didn't fall far from the tree. As she got older, she, you know, while you were trying to set things up so that she was controlling and managing her sickle cell challenges herself, what kind of transition did you see in Fatima as she was growing up and she was a normal teenager, mom, you're not so smart. How did you see her develop in terms of her taking charge and her being more independent?
Yeah, I think I came off at the beginning as the meanest mom in the world, like she was alluding to, because all I wanted is when I'm not there, that they should be able to stand on their own 2 feet. Mm-hmm. So in the process of doing all of that, I remember her fighting me to go to the University of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, no, that's too far from home. Mm-hmm. That's too far from home. But as she was fighting me, I realized that, oh, Lord, she's just like me. I came thousands of miles from my mom, you know, and now she's going away. But I was taking confidence in the fact that they were involved. Fatima was very involved in knowing what was going on with her body. Mm-hmm. And like she said, rather than cuddle them, I used to say, okay, you're going to take your medication and your day is going to go on. Knowing fully well that in my heart of hearts, all I just want to do is hold and say, the pain is going to go away. Mm-hmm. But that was not going to help when I'm not there. And I knew I couldn't have been there 24/7 mm-hmm. all the days of her life. So she came out. She did really well. It was tough for mom. Mm. You know, I could just crawl and cry and say, oh, why me? But, hey, that wasn't in the books for then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
But she dealt with a lot of attitude.
It wasn't an easy road.
Yeah. Mm. A lot of attitude, a lot of, you're not my doctor. You don't know. It's my body. Mm-hmm. I know my body. It's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I know my body. Anyway. That's I know my body. Mm-hmm. She'll like, are you sure you should dress a bit warmer or you look tired? Maybe you should go to sleep. Oh, I know my body. And you know, when you're 16, you know every single thing about the world. So mm-hmm. no one can tell you. So that was difficult. Like, but I think actually our pediatrician, Dr. Osmani, really helped you like learn to set boundaries. Mm-hmm. And she's just, I remember her telling you, mommy, remember that like, you're just going to have to let them fall. And if they get sick,
She used to say, if you don't want your hydrocephalus, I'll see you in the 7th floor, 6th floor, a few months.
Yeah, yeah.
So she would say, don't take it. Why should you? Don't take it if you don't want to.
Yeah, hydroxyurea as a maintenance medication for sickle cell.
You didn't want to take it?
Yeah, there was just a time when, I don't know, I was like, I don't want to take it. I'm like, in your mind, I just believe that, okay, I feel better now, I'm okay, and mm-hmm. I don't want to be different, even though nobody's seeing you take the medication, so it really makes no logical sense. So I was like, I'm not going to take it. Like, who am I protesting against? Who am I, like, I'm mm-hmm. only hurting myself. So my mom used to, like, force us, we argue about it, then she'll say, okay, stand here, early morning, I'm going to watch you take it, and then finally, her, after meeting for the millionth time with the hematologist like, just leave her, don't take it. And I was like, wait, what? Like, yeah, don't take it. Your body, you know your health, so whatever. And I was like, wait, what? So then I didn't take it, and I got sick, and then I was in the hospital. And really, and it was just like, usually when I go to hospital, my dad is the big softy, so he'll bring us, like, Dunkin' Donuts, like, lots of sweets, and are you okay? And my mom would just be like, oh, you're here. Okay. Mm-hmm. See you when you get out. And that kind of tough love was made me realize how dumb that was. Because I think sometimes when you're that young, you just want to, you would fight with the wind if you could, just mm-hmm. with the air or whatever. And the mom's always a perfect target.
Fatima, your kids are really young, but mm-hmm. your daughter is getting to the place now where she's, how old is your older daughter?
She turned 2 in April.
2. That's young, but I'm sure she's asserting herself. So how's that going?
It's horrible. It's horrible. And she's just like me, which is the worst part. So my parents don't help. I can't complain to them because they love it. They're like loving every moment of this. She's just really so similar to me, which is like very irritating. I'm like, wow. God really plays a good one on you sometimes, like mm-hmm. so I'm working mm-hmm. through it. I'm just realizing that I'm not, the number one thing is I'm trying not to take it personally and just self-talking my way through it, because I don't want to discipline out of anger. Mm-hmm. So when I get angry like that, and I have to remind myself, look, she's 2 and she's testing the boundary, so I have to take time out to myself too mm-hmm. and breathe through it, then come back. And one thing, I stay home with my kids, and it's a huge sacrifice for our family for me to do that. Mm-hmm. So I try to say yes, and I try to give her that freedom at times, because mm-hmm. I know when the times I need to say no, it really needs to mean no. And I don't ever want to go up to my kids and lose. I want them to know that if you're going toe-to-toe with mom, you will lose. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, I don't know how realistic that's going to be, but mm-hmm. so far it's working. With that in mind, I'm trying to be more of a yes. If I can say yes, I will say yes. I'm trying mm-hmm. to be that. Or if you go for a walk, something as simple as like, okay, you lead the way. We'll all follow Zubeda. She loves it, thrives off of it. And I find mm-hmm. that the tantrums are a lot less for the rest of the day. They want to mm-hmm. feel, because they're human beings, they want to feel control. They want to have some sort of power.
Yeah.
And so right now I can play the mind games and still win, but soon she's going to get better at those too and win the mind games.
Well, you have a good example to follow. Sounds like your mom was pretty good at it.
She did. And I think she let me, to the dismay of like a very authoritative extended Nigerian family mm-hmm. who just said no for the hell of it. Oh. And she really tried to be a yes mom. And like, she would take us to cultural events out in the mm-hmm. city and ride the train to Boston. And it's funny, now that we're older, I realized that my other cousins were super jealous of that. The fact that she said, yes, go to Pittsburgh, and just was like, fine, you're in God's hand, I trust you. It means so much to me today mm-hmm. that it makes me want to build a daughter who's independent enough and trust mm-hmm. herself enough to try in the world. Like, in the world, just try and trust that you can do it, and that God will keep you safe. And I just hope that my prayers for her always keep her safe. And that's all you can hope for and pray for. Mm-hmm. It's harder that way, though. I wish I was the cuddly parent. I feel like it's much easier in some ways.
Yeah. It's probably easier in the moment. We would try to come up with choices that were both okay with us. Then they would get the opportunity to say what they wanted to do. That was conversations I had often was, so what would be the consequences of, okay, go with what they want to do? And we know that's like idiocy, but it's not like running across a busy street. You don't do that. But most things aren't that serious.
It really isn't. And I feel like a lot of times we get into our feelings as parents. It's like, no, I'm the parent. It's like, bro, you're not God. You're just a parent. You just happen to, they just happen to pass through you. I don't know why moms, especially, like, we're just so wound up, especially the stay-at-home mom. It's really stereotypical, but really, I'm like, I don't even want to hang out with you. Like, your poor kids. Like, and I know my kids don't always like me, and they always won't. They won't always like me. My mom used to always say, it's okay. I don't need you to be my friend. I already have friends. So if you want to be angry, that's your problem. Like, I don't even care.
I want to ask you one more thing. Excuse my language, but being involved with the medical system so much is like really a shit show.
It is.
And there's just, that's just the way it is. And sometimes it's just absurd. I know that for myself, when I can find the humor in it and just have a good laugh at how ridiculous it gets. I mean, not in the moment, obviously, but sometimes afterwards. So what have you guys had a good laugh over that when it happened, it was like outrageous?
That blows my mind. It just makes me delirious, like angry, especially when I'm dealing with doctors who are not used to sickle cell patients. So when I come to the ER and I'm in excruciating pain, granted, I still have to put on my eyebrows and look decent and change out of my pajamas and be in slightly uncomfortable clothing and wear a bra. One day I forgot, I always have to wear my wedding ring, preferably my engagement ring on top so they can actually see I'm married. I have to speak really proper because I have to do all these things to show them that I'm not drug seeking. Preferably, if my husband can come with the kids, that's always better. But being in the ER with kids really stinks, so that's not always ideal. Or at least my husband has a video chat so they know I do have a husband. And all these little things together makes them feel like you're not drug seeking. And then one time I did get a doctor who was like, well, you don't seem like you're in pain. You're calm. I said, you know why I'm calm? Because if I talk to you like Shaquana, then you're going to say that, oh, I'm from the wrong side
angry
of the
black
and that I'm drug seeking. Yeah, that I'm the angry black lady and I'm drug seeking. Really? I'm drug seeking? In this life of the drug opiate crisis, you think I can't just walk down the street and get some powerful fentanyl? Why the hell would I come here for a little pinch of morphine? Drug seeking. I leave my two children who are under the age of two, my husband, my comfortable house to come and beg you for a little dose of morphine, yes, because I'm drug seeking. This is the best place I want to be on a Friday night. The only thing I have to do is come to the emergency room and talk to you. And that kind of sarcasm, like he was just shocked, like, oh, you're really speaking to me this way? Like he was just flabbergasted, had no response, nothing to say. And I said this all in the calmest voice possible because, and then after he left the room and I didn't even see him for the rest of the night, but I got immediately all the medication I needed and he brought me straight up to the room and that was the end of that. And I was like, thank you, sir. Yes, Friday night. I wanted to come and talk to you, beg for little doses of morphine that is not even hitting the pain. Like, do you even know how miserable I am right now? And you're telling me because I'm calm and collected that I'm not in pain? Like, I wish you knew. Actually, I don't even wish it on my worst enemy. So talking in that kind of sarcastic way, it's all funny now, but at the moment, it's infuriating. Like, I really had to breathe through putting on these most uncomfortable pants just so I don't walk in with pajama pants and just so you don't categorize me. And it just makes me so sad because I'm like, what if I was a single mom? What if I was 5-10 years younger? What if I did have two kids? What if I was on welfare? Does that make me less of a human being? Like, it just breaks my heart. And it might sound horrible that I'm leveraging certain social economic privileges, but at that moment, that's all I have. All I have, like, my skin is brown. At the end of the day, I'm black. It doesn't matter that my parents are immigrants from Nigeria. It doesn't matter that I have doctors and nurses and lawyers in my family. Nobody cares. All at that moment, all they see, because they're trying to take a quick assessment because they don't want to get in trouble for giving someone drugs. And I kind of try to see it from their perspective too. They're just trying to make the quickest, fastest assessment without knowing you. Are you in pain? What do you need? It just stinks. The whole system really sucks. And I feel like it makes really good doctors and good PAs become horrible, mean, narcissistic racist, you know, because no doctor, no nurse is actually racist, but there's so much racism in the system, but magically none of them are actually racist. Hmm. It's heartbreaking.
It is.
And when I talk to my friends who are medical professionals, it breaks my heart because it's not easy for them either. And there are people who abuse the system. I just don't know how we can fix it.
Catch-22.
What were you saying there, Isosa?
I said catch-22.
It is a catch-22. It really is.
What should I be asking you that I'm not about this journey you've been on together?
Yeah, I think I don't know if I talked to you about it before. I just, all I know is that it takes a toll on the family. Everyone in the family suffers with the patients. I don't think people get it. Sometimes I tell, like when I'm really getting so tired, I'll say, oh my God, caregivers sometimes die before the people they care for. You know, I will say things like that, but thank God I'm alive to see my grandchildren. But it takes a toll on the whole family, the siblings, the parents, the extended family even, those who are willing to participate in all of this. It does take a toll. Mm-hmm. I wish when doctors are treating patients, they think of their families and not just concentrate on the patient and the patient alone.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was thinking as I was thinking about this call, the series that I've been doing is you're the third pair of young adult parent that I've spoken to. Mm-hmm. The people that I haven't spoken to are the non-main caregiver. So like your dad or your husband, mm-hmm. like Aziz, or your dad, Fatima, or what you're saying, Isosa, is so important that it's a family business when anybody is suffering. It is.
Her perspective actually has made me think about, has helped my relationship with my husband too, because now he's the main caregiver in our immediate family.
Hi. I'm hearing somebody there.
Now, hi, guys.
Hi.
Yes. You don't...
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, we can say hi when I'm done, inshallah, okay?
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I can let you go. This is great.
But I just wanted to say one thing. Like seeing what toll it took on my mom as a caregiver has changed my perspective. Like, it really isn't all about me. So now that my husband is in that kind of caregiver role, again, it's difficult because I never had to have these deep conversations with my mom. Because we grew into it. She already knew everything about my care. So having to sit down, explain stuff to my husband, educate him, and it's frustrating because when you're in pain, you're like, can't you just know it? But how could he know it? It's not his life experience. It's not. So that has, and she always checks in with Aziz all the time, like, how are you, Aziz? And ask him questions that I know he always is moved by, but doesn't, like, I feel like she wouldn't know how to respond to him as nicely and gently as she does if she didn't have that experience herself. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like transferring of caregiving roles.
Yeah. Which,
it's like a whole nother topic.
That's so interesting. I interviewed a young lady who's in college now, and she's had a chronic illness, I think, since she was 12. And so she's in college in Alabama, and her mother lives in D.C. She has a boyfriend, and her boyfriend has only ever gone to the doctor to have a physical for sports. And it sounds like they've been together a couple of years, and it sounds like he's a great guy who has learned the role and accepted it. That's something you and I used to talk about. Who's the team? There's the team is always obviously the medical people, but it's also the lay people, your family, your coworkers, your whatever. You know, I think like you and I, the reason, Fatima, you and I worked well together is that although you had to educate me about sickle cell because I was completely ignorant, but I understood having a chronic illness.
Then
it was easier to figure out, well, how are we going to do the work? Because we could appreciate that.
With you changed so much because it made me realize that I can do things. I can do it as long as I have adjustments. And what adjustments am I going to make for myself? And what adjustments do I have to ask for? Because if you had a chronic illness, so I think that was a blessing in disguise that you were my first like real employer out of college. So now, you again, I didn't have to ask for certain things. You just understood and knew. But now it taught me that, okay, now if I'm going to an environment, how do I bring up these conversations? How do I have them? What do I need to ask for, you know?
Right.
So I feel like it really was a life lesson for myself and actually opened up my mind to the possibilities of what I could do and what I could be with the right adjustments, if that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense.
I'm so thankful for that.
Yeah, well,
I learned a lot. It was an education.
You should listen to my podcast with the interview with you, because the way I introduced you is to tell what you taught me.
Oh,
so
Danny, I can't wait to hear it. Now I'm going to hear it. I'm going to be
okay. Because yes, and Isosa, I need you to know that I learned a lot from your daughter.
Oh, thank you so much, Danny. That's just so nice. Yeah, thank you.
He knows how much I adore you. I was like, oh, Danny said this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, it was mutual. I was telling somebody that the way I've been introducing myself these days is that I'm a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege.
I heard that part.
and really,
probably goes silent when you say that.
What's that?
The room probably goes silent when you say that, because there are not many people who actually understand that concept.
Well, and
I'm sure black people come up and hug you. Do they do
well,
that?
Well, not really, but I would say that working with you and getting to know you, I learned to accept this is who I am, and I don't need to be. I don't need to be ashamed of it, because sometimes I would be ashamed of it.
Why? But, it's a blessing because you help bring other people. You know, we can't do any, we can't make changes by ourselves. So when we have people in powers and privilege who are privileged, it helps the cause of, you know, equality. And remember Catherine and I and Mary were like just flabbergasted talking about how you chose to hire us. And you were like, what's the big deal? You were the best. I was like, no, it is a big deal because we know we were the best, but still not get chosen because of, you know, technical whatever. And we all knew what it was. And you were, I think the fact that you were so shocked about that was so endearing. We're like, wait, you didn't know that?
That was one of the most life-changing conversations I had ever had. Was when you guys sat me down and had that conversation like I was, you know, you have no idea. That was totally changed my life, that conversation.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having an open mind. I'm really grateful that your mind is so open that you are willing to make changes on everyone's behalf.
Really?
So I'm so grateful that Fatima met you.
Me too.
And your beautiful wife is just a pleasant human being. She's just so blessed.
I just seem so zen. I was like, I wish I had that calmness. Maybe life, the hard knocks of life makes you calm like that.
I don't know.
It's amazing.
We don't have those genes.
I don't know. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you so much
for your patience.
The time. And Fatima, we will talk soon because I have some stuff we need to talk about.
Okay.
So
thank you, Danny.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Isosa.
Bye, Mommy.
No problem. Thank you. Have a good night. Everyone, blessings.
Okay, bye.
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 First, I was Fatima's boss. I worked at Advocates, Inc. Advocates supports about 23,000 people with disabilities. I was vice president for quality management, looking for an executive assistant. When I interviewed Fatima, I found her bright, energized, and a bit irreverent. She had a bachelor's degree. She was so far ahead of any other candidate. The pay I had to offer was underwhelming. All I really needed to know to make the decision would be that she would enthusiastically support the mission of the organization. When she told me that her parents had worked for Advocates, I offered her the job. She accepted. I soon learned two things about Fatima. Day one, she's sitting in her cube, looking quite forlorn. What's the matter? I said. I don't know where to pray. I had the only office in the suite. So I said, use my office. I can sit at your desk. How long do you pray for? 5 minutes, she said. I thought it would have been 30 minutes. I was so ignorant. A few weeks later, Fatima calls from the hospital. I'm in the hospital. I can't come in. I'm so sorry. No worries, I said. Take care of yourself. Let me know what I can do. The next morning, I came in, and I found some work from her in my inbox. She had taken her laptop with her and had worked from her hospital bed. So let's talk about being the boss of a person with disabilities. Now, really, let's talk about being the boss of a person. People have families and abilities that vary with time, including me. Working with kind, skilled, compassionate people is a blessing. We can figure it out. We can figure it out together. Someone else needs to know everybody's work. While balancing efficiency, productivity, meeting schedules can be challenging with caregiving of children, parents, and self, it's possible. Life happens. Tragedy happens. We just need to be upfront about it and plan mindfully together. The whole team needs to plan. It can happen to anybody. It's so worth it. It's a joy to lead a dynamite team. So Fatima and I started as boss and employee, became colleagues, and grew to be close friends. I'm thankful for that.
Follow my blog, podcasts, and resources through my website. See you around the block.